From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Consistent with the Mitchell Plan, Israeli settlement activity in occupied territories must stop.
President Bush alters course on the Middle East and promises to send General Colin Powell next week, just the time Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says he needs. The Israeli forces continue to try and storm the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, believed to be the birthplace of Jesus Christ, where hundreds of Palestinians have been confined for days. We'll get a report from inside the church. We also have news that a French reporter was shot in Manger Square. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! This is Resistance Radio. President Bush reversed course yesterday and urged Israel to end its violent invasion of the occupied territories immediately. He also announced Secretary of State General Colin Powell will travel to Israel next week. The first half of the Rose Garden speech appeared to be no different from any other, as he explained Israel's need to defend itself and said the situation that Palestinian President Yasser Arafat finds himself in is largely of his own making. He said, since September 11th, I've delivered this message. Everyone must choose. You're either with the civilized world or you're with the terrorists. But he then called on Israel to end its invasion of Palestinian cities and towns. He told Israel to stop all settlement activity, withdraw to UN-recognized borders. And he told Israel to show respect and concern for the dignity of the Palestinian people and make efforts to spare, quote, innocent Palestinians' daily humiliation. We turn now to a human rights attorney who is currently in Bethlehem. His name is Shaki Issa, Director of the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and the Environment. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you respond to President Bush's what seems like an about-face, saying he'll send Colin Powell next week?
Well, basically, first of all, Sharon's office already said, no, we'll continue our incursion. This was the first reaction from Sharon's office. But what Mr. Bush was saying, I believe he's responsible, if not the same as Sharon, maybe more, of all these war crimes committed right now in Palestinian cities, including Bethlehem, where I am now. Bush basically gave a license to Sharon to continue or maybe to kill Arafat by holding Arafat responsible for all what's going on, when in fact the American administration knows very well, more than others, that Sharon and only Sharon is responsible of killing the peace process and freezing it and killing any opportunity for future normal peace between Israel and Palestine. When this intifada started, it started peacefully. And only after Sharon was elected, it converted to military actions from both sides. Shortly after the intifada started, the United Nations decided to investigate, to establish a committee to investigate what's going on. But Sharon refused, and the Americans immediately came to help him and replaced the UN resolution by creating Mitchell Committee. After Mitchell Committee made its recommendations, again Sharon refused because calling for freezing the settlements. Again, Mr. Bush saved Sharon and made Tenet Committee, which is alternative to the Mitchell report. Again, Sharon refused Tenet plan. So he sent Zini, and Zini now is replacing Tenet plan with his own document, which is basically Sharon's opinion. Nothing different between Sharon document and Zini document. So this is how the American administration is protecting this war criminal, Sharon, and giving him impunity and using veto every time. And when Bush yesterday saying that he's calling to stop the humiliations of Palestinians at Israeli checkpoints, let's remember how many times American presidents or foreign ministers or whoever in American administration repeated this sentence. Since a year and a half, every day they are saying it, and Sharon refusing what they did, just repeating. So Bush has to remember that this humiliation didn't appear just before his speech. It's been going on, and they've been calling Israel to stop it, and they never did. Did he blame Sharon for anything? No, all the blame on the Palestinians. He kept repeating that Israelis are his friends. Okay, but Palestinians are not a human being he doesn't care about. And when he's calling on Israel to immediately evacuate and leave the cities, and immediately Sharon saying, no, we'll continue, what did he say? Nothing. He never blamed Israel with anything.
Shaki,
now, I am sitting in the front of the hospital of Bethlehem, and just half an hour ago, a French hospital near the major square was shot in the leg, and until now, the ambulance didn't arrive to bring his him to the hospital.
Wait, can you stop? Can you explain, say again, a French reporter?
Yeah, he was at near major square trying to get reports for his agency, and the Israeli soldiers shot him a bullet in his leg, and until now, the ambulance is trying to bring him to the hospital.
You're sitting with him?
Sorry?
You are sitting with him?
No, no, he's injured in the major square. I'm sitting near the hospital.
Ah.
And the ambulance went to bring him. We are waiting for the ambulance to bring him.
And who is he?
We have confirmed reports from another journalist sitting with him. He said to us just the French journalist was shot just now and hung up. We didn't get the name even. But we know that there is a group from France Press there right now in the major square. So he must be one of this group.
Agence France Press.
Yeah. And just before that, two Palestinians were shot. And 2 hours until they allowed the ambulance to bring them. The ambulance was 5 meters from the two injured bleeding. And the Israeli soldiers didn't allow them to take them to the hospital. A day before, a Palestinian was shot at midnight in the major square in his leg. And he himself called the ambulance from the cell phone saying, I am injured and bleeding in the major square. And the ambulance arrived there, but the soldiers didn't allow him to take him to hospital. And he kept bleeding until he died next morning. And his body was in the major square about 24 hours before we could get it to the hospital. We have many examples. A woman and her son inside their house were killed in the old city of Bethlehem. And their kids and the brother of the one killed, the son of the mother, the other son, they were in the apartment, which is one room and the bathroom, 30 hours with the two bodies before the Israelis allowed our ambulance to bring them. Everybody interfered from Vatican to Geneva, the Red Cross. And it took 30 hours to Israeli war criminals to allow to take the two dead bodies from the apartments where children sitting, kids between the bodies. What more than these war crimes?
Shaki Issa.
What can move the American administration to do something?
Shaki Issa, director of the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and the Environment. What do you expect could happen in this next week before Colin Powell comes?
Well, basically, Bush gave Sharon another week to continue his crimes before Colin Powell comes. And anyway, he will not be able to do anything unless he addresses the root of the problem, the root of the conflict, which is the occupation itself. Well, I believe, and everybody here believes, that until the Israeli occupation finishes, we'll never have peace. Ceasefire will never be respected unless the occupation finishes. This is the major problem everybody must address.
Shaki Issa, as you stand outside of the hospital waiting for the French reporter to be brought into the hospital, we also have on the line with us Tony Salmon, who is inside the Church of the Nativity. The French reporter shot in Manger Square. The Israeli tanks have surrounded that whole area. We are going to get a report from inside the Church of the Nativity. Tony Salmon is with the Antonian Charitable Society, a Roman Catholic institution in Bethlehem. He came with the governor of Bethlehem to the Church of the Nativity 2 days ago and is still inside the church. Can you describe the scene there, Tony Salmon?
Yes, the situation here in the church is still going worse to worse. The situation is very bad. No food, no medicine. There is very need to make a surgery to an injured person inside the church. We try by the Red Cross during the last 4 days to bring food, medicine inside the church. They refused till the moment the Israelis to allow the Red Cross to enter the church. Also, we have people that they have blood pressure and sugar in blood. who are in need, very need to have medicines, and we have several cases that need treatment. The situation here is very bad. We are hoping that the Red Cross and other institutions, world human rights institutions, can put pressure on Israel and put an end to what's going on in the Nativity Church, because it's a very dangerous situation. We can't continue solving the problem of the people who enter the church without receiving the medicines and the food for them.
Tony Salmon, I believe this is one of the first reports that we in the United States are hearing from inside the Church of the Nativity. What we hear described in the United States is that the Israeli soldiers have surrounded the Church of the Nativity because there are 200 Palestinian gunmen inside. Who is inside this church?
This is something I don't know how the American media can accept these things. The Church of Nativity is a place, a holy place, a place for prayers, and also a place who offer protection to anybody ask this protection. This church was, during its history, a place where the people want to have a protection and safe on themselves, enter the church asking for this. Now, as a reality, no matter whom they are inside the church, if we want to speak from a human rights or a human being or a civilian point of view, the important is people asking their protection and safety inside the church. They entered not for resistance, as what the Israeli tried to say or to do, to explain to the world. They ran away from the main square around the Church of the Nativity, running for the Israeli shooting. Because at that day, there was a big, big, big shooting around the square when the people tried to stop the fire that was in the Mosque of Omar, which is opposite the Church of the Nativity. So they ran away from that place, and there was no way to run, just to enter the Church of the Nativity asking for protection and safe. Now, the Israeli from time to time saying a lot of stories, and the last story that they said, that they said that the priests and nuns in the church taken hostages. It is also not true. The situation inside the church is very quiet. The people there waiting for food and medicine, also waiting to this problem to be solved peacefully by political issues. And the political issues that the people waiting and we waiting is a political issue by Chairman Arafat, who is the president of the Palestinian people and the authorized person to speak or to come to any agreement concerning any problem touch the interests of the Palestinian people.
We're speaking to Tony Salmon with the Antonian Charitable Society, a Roman Catholic institution in Bethlehem, went into the Church of the Nativity in Manger Square with the mayor of Bethlehem 2 days ago, has remained there with hundreds of other people who are holed up as the Israeli military is on the outside. There is also conflicting reports on what has happened to the church, this ancient site that is believed to be the place that Jesus Christ was born. Has the door at the back been blown off? The Israeli military says they have not damaged the church.
It's not truth. The truth that yesterday at about 10:30 local time of Bethlehem, they bombed the southern door of the church, and they opened on the door. There is an open in the door as a result of this bomb. It's here, and anybody can have the time to come, or the Israeli allow him to come. He will see what's going on and if there is this hole or not. It's very clear that it was bombed and the door speaks on itself. But if the Israeli saying contrary to this, let them bring the press media and the media to the door and show them that what happened and what we are sending to the world is explaining to them what's going on. Bring the media, let them bring the media to see if that, which story is the truth.
Shaki Issa is outside of the church. Have you been able to get reports of what's going on inside and what is being reported on Bethlehem television and in the greater area?
Well, as a comment on the last thing Tony said, that you can see any journalist trying to reach the chair to take photos, they shoot him, as what happened with a French journalist just a short time ago. So we have confirmed reports that they did blow the southern gate of the church, and the glasses in the windows also were broken in result. We have confirmation about this. We have confirmation that injured people are inside the church, and they don't allow us to bring him to bring them here. I just got the news that the French hospital was taken to the French hospital. The French journalist was taken to the French hospital in Bethlehem, which is another hospital in Bethlehem. The local TVs and the local journalists, it's very difficult for them to move, even more difficult than the foreign journalists, but they all targeted. So it's difficult to receive information unless we call house to house in the old city and get the information from the people who are living there around the Church of the Nativity.
Tony Salmon, inside the Church of the Nativity, are people afraid of a massacre?
Yes, they are afraid, but they are sure at the end that still the Church of the Nativity, as was before all the history that passed on this church, will keep them in safe and will protect them. They still, with all the circumstances that they are living and the Israeli shooting on the church and bombing around the church, they are still believing that the church will protect them, because the blessing of Jesus Christ is still in the church, and the church will continue protecting any person enter the church asking for protection. That sent the Church of the Nativity during its history always was a place of protection and safe for the people. There was many wars and many occupation and many problems in the Holy Land in Palestine during the history, and almost the people, when they were feeling danger, they were entering the church and have the protection that they need. And we believe that the blessing of Jesus Christ inside the church and will protect the people, and the people will be safe. And we hope that this problem will be ended a peacefully way, politically way, and the people go back home to their families.
Tony Salmon, why don't you leave? You came in with the mayor of Bethlehem. You're with the Antonian Charitable.
I am ready to leave if it's not dangerous.
What is the Antonian Charitable Society, the Roman Catholic group that you are with?
It's a humanitarian society that gives services and help in Bethlehem.
And are people inside negotiating with the Israeli military right now?
According to my information, there is nobody negotiating with the Israelis. According to my information, nobody. Because it's clear that this negotiation must be by Chairman Arafat, who is the responsible and the authorized person in any matter, as I said, touching the interests of the Palestinian people.
So where are people staying inside the church right now?
Inside the church, you said. Where they are staying inside the church? Inside the church.
Just all together?
Yes.
Yeah. And do you have any medical supplies?
I said the situation is very, very, very difficult.
Do you think whom enter
injured since Tuesday afternoon? Now it's Friday in Bethlehem. They did not receive any medical treatment, but the first aid that the nuns of the convent of the Franciscan Father offered them, which is a very, very, very poor first aid treatment.
Do you think
there is someone that needs a surgery? He must pass the surgery, or his life is in danger, and his situation is a very serious situation.
Do you think the Israeli military might be starving you out or preventing supplies coming in, so that would force you all to surrender?
For me, I have nothing to. I am not surrender, and I am. It's not. I have nothing to do with that, because I am. Let's say not. they are not asking for me. I am not a person who is endangered on his life, or his, I can go out anytime if the Israelis will allow us or allow somebody to go from the church peacefully.
I'd like to get your comment, Tony Salmon, who's inside the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem right now, of a quote in the New York Times of Israeli Colonel Marcel Aviv, an Israeli army commander. He says, "All the people inside the church are hostages. We began negotiations with the terrorists last night and offered to send in doctors and medicine for the wounded, but they said no."
It's not true. I have here fathers near me and hearing what I am saying, and nobody, not the fathers and not myself and not the governor, are hostages. We are trying to make a civil work, a humanitarian work, concerning people asking help and asking protection inside the Church of the Nativity. This is our duty, and this is what we try to do in the time being, till a solution will come as a result of political issues and negotiation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis and the Americans, and whom they are responsible on what's going on inside the church.
As we speak right now, apparently Yasser Arafat is meeting with General Zinni, the U.S. envoy, and President Bush last night said that he's sending Colin Powell next week, the Secretary of State. Does that matter to you inside the church?
It doesn't mean nothing, because if the President Bush is interested in solving all what is going on in Palestine, and he's ready, he can send Paul direct when he declares that he's going to send Paul. He can ask Paul to leave to the Middle East and begin negotiating and solving problem. But when he says that he is going to send him on Sunday, let's say, it means that he will come here to Bethlehem or to the Middle East on Tuesday, because he will leave Washington on Sunday, Washington time, which means Monday morning in Bethlehem. So he will come here till on Tuesday. And that means that Sharon and his group will continue attacking the Palestinian people, put their life in danger another 3 or 4 days, which is very dangerous situation, and which is means that there is no serious procedures from the American government toward what's going on in the occupied territories and the Palestinian Palestinian National Authority zones.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Tony Salmon, with the Antonian Charitable Society, Roman Catholic Institution, Bethlehem. He is inside the Church of the Nativity, the scene of hundreds of people holed up inside the Israeli military surrounding the area. It is a closed military zone. And as we had a report just outside in Manger Square, at least one French reporter has been shot. We got that report from Shaki Issa, who is the director of the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and the Environment. He was speaking to us from outside a hospital where he was waiting for the French reporter to be brought. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we will go to Ramallah, where General Zinni is meeting with Yasser Arafat. Reports are that about 30 journalists were surrounded. They were tear gassed as they tried to cover the meeting. Stay with us. by Aviv Geffen, an Israeli rock star and peace activist, as he sings, "Where have we gone to? Nowhere. You'll end up in a cement home, a grave. God will tuck you in to sleep. The dove is choking on the olive branch. Who's there walking drunk? It's the prime minister. The mother waits for peace to come, but it doesn't. Your son was killed, but we're yet to name the war." This is Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to Ramallah, where General Zinni, the U.S. envoy, is meeting with Yasser Arafat. About 30 reporters attempted to cover the meeting. The latest news we have is that they were surrounded by military tanks, that they were tear gassed. This is at the Palestinian leader's besieged compound, as the reporters attempted to reach the compound, fired tear gas, Israeli soldiers, and stun grenades. Around 30 tanks surrounded the building. Some pointed the barrels of their guns at the journalists. We're joined right now on the telephone from Ramallah by Awad Douadis, who is a reporter for Voice of Palestine in Ramallah. What are you hearing is happening inside with the meeting and outside with the reporters? Awad Douadis.
Concerning the meeting, what we have heard, that the meeting is done. We don't know yet that if General Zinni had left the compound or not. About the journalists, actually, they were attacked and not only surrounded by tanks and by military Israeli jeeps and patrols, and they were attacked by cars. They were attacked by tear gas and also by sound bombs, and they were forbidden even to stay to wait the arrival of General Zinni when he was due to meet Chairman Arafat. So they were attacked, and these journalists are from several nationalities. What we know also that in Ramallah, during the curfew hours, which is all the day, 24 hours a day, they attack journalists, and you know, your Occidental and foreign journalists have usually with them are local producers or translators or local journalists who work together with them. And what happened is that Israeli army attack foreign journalists and arrest Palestinian producers and journalists. So the situation here is even for journalists and even for ambulances is under curfew, total curfew. There is no one on the roads. Yet 2 hours ago, Israeli army had left the curfew for 2 hours only. So people went off to look for food, which is not really existing in the town because it is surrounded and under siege since 8 days. And now everyone is back home under a curfew waiting another lifting of the curfew, maybe 3 or 4 or even 5 days later.
Awad Douadis, you're with the Voice of Palestine. Is it operating?
Oof, this is a very hard question. Actually, Voice of Palestine was attacked several times during this intifada. It was first attacked by Israeli army in October 2000, and then in December 2001, the broadcasting station was totally destructed. Finished up by Israeli army, and also on the 19th of January, Israeli army entered in the studios of Voice of Palestine and destroyed everything. Now, we were broadcasting from on FM wave here in Ramallah, and now it is done totally. It is curfew. We cannot reach the studios, but also my colleagues told me that Israeli army entered in the first day of the invasion of Ramallah and destroyed, blow up actually, all our studios, which were also temporary studios. So we are not broadcasting at all. One of our reporters, which is our reporter in Bethlehem, who was sick and who was injured during this intifada, also was arrested for 6 days, and he was only released yesterday. Now he's really in very bad conditions now.
Awad Douadis speaking to us from Ramallah, reporter for Voice of Palestine, also reports for French Public Radio and Free Speech Radio News. We're going to turn now to an excerpt of the speech that President Bush gave yesterday, reversing course, urging Israel to end the violent invasion of the occupied territories. Also announced that Secretary of State General Colin Powell would travel to Israel next week. The first half of the Rose Garden speech appeared to be no different from any other, as he explained Israel's need to defend itself and said the situation that Palestinian President Yasser Arafat finds himself in is largely of his own making. He said, since September 11th, I've delivered this message. Everyone must choose. You're either with the civilized world or you're with the terrorists. But he then called on Israel to end its invasion of the Palestinian cities. We are going to hear what President Bush had to say.
Since September the 11th, I've delivered this message. Everyone must choose. You're either with the civilized world or you're with the terrorists. All in the Middle East also must choose and must move decisively in word and deed against terrorist acts. The chairman of the Palestinian Authority has not consistently opposed or confronted terrorists. At Oslo and elsewhere, Chairman Arafat renounced terror as an instrument of his cause, and he agreed to control it. He's not done so. The situation in which he finds himself today is largely of his own making. He's missed his opportunities and thereby betrayed the hopes of the people he's supposed to lead. Given his failure, the Israeli government feels it must strike at terrorist networks that are killing its citizens. Yet Israel must understand that its response to these recent attacks is only a temporary measure. All parties have their own responsibilities, and all parties owe it to their own people to act. We all know today's situation runs the risk of aggravating long-term bitterness and undermining relationships that are critical to any hope of peace. I call on the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Authority, and our friends in the Arab world to join us in delivering a clear message to terrorists. Blowing yourself up does not help the Palestinian cause. To the contrary, suicide bombing missions could well blow up the best and only hope for a Palestinian state.
President Bush speaking yesterday in the Rose Garden at the White House. The president-elect then turned his attention to Israel.
Israel faces hard choices of its own. Its government has supported the creation of a Palestinian state that is not a haven for terrorism. Yet Israel also must recognize that such a state needs to be politically and economically viable. Consistent with the Mitchell Plan, Israeli settlement activity in occupied territories must stop. And the occupation must end through withdrawal to secure and recognize boundaries, consistent with United Nations Resolutions 242 and 338. Ultimately, this approach should be the basis of agreements between Israel and Syria and Israel and Lebanon. Israel should also show a respect for and concern about the dignity of the Palestinian people, who are and will be their neighbors. It is crucial to distinguish between the terrorists and ordinary Palestinians seeking to provide for their own families. The Israeli government should be compassionate at checkpoints and border crossings, sparing innocent Palestinians daily humiliation. Israel should take immediate action to ease closures and allow peaceful people to go back to work. Israel is facing a terrible and serious challenge. For 7 days, it has acted to root out terrorist nests. America recognizes Israel's right to defend itself from terror. Yet to lay the foundations of future peace, I ask Israel to halt incursions into Palestinian-controlled areas and begin the withdrawal from those cities it has recently occupied. I speak as a committed friend of Israel. I speak out of a concern for its long-term security, the security that will come with a genuine peace.
President-elect Bush speaking in the Rose Garden yesterday, reversing direction and saying, in fact, he will send General Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, to the Middle East next week. As we broadcast today, General Zinni has just met with Yasser Arafat in his besieged compound in Ramallah. We're joined on the telephone by Stephen Zunis, senior policy analyst and Middle East editor at Foreign Policy in Focus and chair of the Peace and Justice Studies Department at the University of San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me in.
Well, first, your response to the speech.
Nothing too different than what we've heard before, except that the president did say that the withdrawal should at least begin right away. Before then, it had been rather vague, eventually, when they're ready, sort of thing. Also, for the first time, he actually said the occupation must end. And though his definition of what's occupied territory and what's not is something that's not quite clear, I think what we're seeing is that, finally, there are some people in the Bush administration who are beginning to recognize that the Israeli response is so beyond the pale that it is going to make it very, very difficult for the United States to have any credibility in the Arab world, even among the conservative pro-Western governments. And indeed, we've been losing credibility among our European allies and just about anybody else in the world about having any pretense of being an honest broker in the so-called peace process.
Well, let's talk about that issue of being an honest broker. The U.S. press is continually talking about the U.S. having to get involved. The U.S. is deeply involved in Israel. The number one arms supplier to Israel, for example. Can you talk about U.S. interests there?
Well, certainly. The lack of involvement had to do with the fact that the Bush administration position seemed to be, the two parties need to work it out among themselves, so, which is kind of like telling the East Timorese and Indonesians to work it out among themselves. And it ignores the gross asymmetry in power between the Palestinians and the Israeli occupiers. But our involvement, of course, is extensive. Over $2 billion of military aid, highly sophisticated armaments that go well beyond what Israel needs for its legitimate defense needs. And indeed, the United States is quite open that it's for the sake of ensuring Israeli military superiority, not parity, which those of us in international relations recognize as the most stable relationship, except for disarmament, of course, but actual military superiority, which includes the ability to maintain this occupation force. Also, Israel gets over $2 billion in various kinds of economic aid. You know, Israel is about 1/1000th of the world's population and actually is one of the top 20 wealthiest countries in the world per capita, yet they get nearly a third of the U.S. foreign aid budget. And this, of course, does not include the fact that the United States has used its veto power in the United Nations over the past 30 or so years to block censorship or sanctions against Israel for its violations of international law more times than all other permanent members of the Security Council have used their veto power on all other issues combined. So this combination of military, economic, and diplomatic support is truly unprecedented. I mean, it far surpasses, you know, what the Soviets did for Cuba, far surpasses in terms of numbers and in terms of amount of what the United States sent to South Vietnam, even. Yet, it is something that has bipartisan support. You'll find very few people, even conservatives who normally oppose foreign aid and liberals who usually raise concerns about human rights. It's an unprecedented kind of relationship, and we are very, very much involved, and in the irony, of course, is we combine this high-level support by claiming that we, and we alone, should be the sole mediators in the conflict at the exclusion of the Europeans, United Nations, and the other party.
We're talking to Stephen Zunis on the line with us with Foreign Policy in Focus. In the studio with us, we're joined by Ifat Suskind, who's Associate Director of MADRE, International Women's Human Rights Organization. Ifat is an Israeli currently living in Brooklyn, New York. The United States rejected this week the proposal from the United Nations top human rights official, Mary Robinson, to immediately send observers to the Palestinian territories to obtain information and make recommendations about the severe deterioration of the situation there. The significance of this, Ifat?
Well, Tuesday's blocking of the formation of an observer force is actually the third time that the Bush administration has vetoed or said that it would veto the creation of an international force that would be sent essentially to help protect Palestinians who are living under Israeli occupation. And as we just heard, it's part of a larger and far-reaching pattern of over 30 vetoes that the U.S. Has implemented on the Security Council. Almost every time the Security Council wants to condemn Israeli human rights violations against Palestinians, the U.S. has been there to block it. You know, it became very explicit under the Clinton administration when spokespeople in that administration said openly that international law was compromising their ability to conduct Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Madeleine Albright had said when she was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations in 1994 that the goal of the U.S. that year, 1 year after the signing of the Declaration of Principles between Israel and the PLO, was to make all previous U.N. resolutions against Israel irrelevant because there were not now bilateral negotiations. It's very, very clear, and this latest blocking of observers by Bush is just another example of the fact that the United States does not want the United Nations to be the address for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Ifat Suskind, the U.S. Relationship with Palestinian leaders in history, what is that history? And I'd like to also put that question to Stephen Zunis, but Ifat first.
Well, I mean, the U.S. position towards the Palestinian leadership has been one of rejectionism, essentially, which is a word that's in this country mostly identified with the Palestinian position. In fact, you know, the reality is almost the inverse, that at least since, you know, the early 1970s, there has been, in that time it was called Kissinger's Doctrine of Stalemate, which meant essentially that there were going to be no negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians supported by the United States, and that the United States' attitude towards the Palestinian leadership was essentially to back Israel in the use of force to deal with that leadership.
Stephen Zunis.
The United States for many years would not allow the Palestinians to take part in the peace process until three conditions were met. One was that they accepted UN Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338 as the basis of negotiation. Secondly, that they renounce violence against civilians. And thirdly, that they recognize Israel. What was interesting about these demands is they didn't make comparable demands against demands on Israel, because Israel also rejected 242 and 338, particularly during the Likud government. They also committed acts of violence against civilians, which far surpassed in terms of number of casualties of the Palestinian attacks, and they were not asked to similarly recognize Palestine's right to exist. But despite all that, the PLO eventually agreed to these demands in 1988, but still the United States refused to allow them to take part in the peace process and started in Madrid, and indeed only allowed a Palestinian delegation if none of them were from the diaspora, none of them were from Jerusalem, and none of them had any affiliation with the PLO, and they were under the Jordanian flag. I think it's the first time a facilitator of a major peace conference has actually insisted that they could essentially name, you know, who was on one of the participating delegations. So this is, you know, fairly typical pattern of negating the Palestinians to be able to choose their own leadership, and I think it shows that this pattern of disdain that the Palestinians even have such basic rights. Indeed, by claiming all UN Security Council resolutions were irrelevant. It basically demonstrated that not only was the U.S. Willing to, I mean, even my intro students in international relations can claim that no bilateral agreement can supersede the U.N. Security Council resolutions, particularly if if the Secretary General, if none of the other members of the Security Council, and if one of the two parties in that bilateral process still say they are very relevant. So by taking those away, they also took away the only real card the Palestinians had left, which was international law, which was very clearly on their side. And whatever one may think of Hamas or Arafat or anything like that, on virtually every outstanding issue in the peace process, the Palestinian position is far more consistent with international law than the Israeli position or the U.S. position, for that matter.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. Our guests are Stephen Zunis on the telephone with us. Stephen Zunis is with Foreign Policy in Focus. We are also joined in the studio by Yifat Seskind, Associate Director of MADRE, International Women's Human Rights Organization. We're going to talk about the history of U.S.-Israeli relations, also AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, and the U.S. military-industrial complex. Stay with us.
Millions of people around the world say no to nuclear war. As the powers that be keep destroying the earth, we are joined by a million more. Good for the world for turning out. Good for the world for turning out. Good for the world for turning out. Let your spirit soar. Good for the world for hanging on. Good for the world for hanging on. Good for the world for hanging on. When we hang on, it's good for the world.
The water is wide. Holly Neer, Arla Guthrie, Ronnie Gilbert, Pete Seeger, their CD, A Time to Sing, Harp. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the turnaround right now, at least it seems to be, with President Bush saying he will send Colin Powell to the Middle East next week, concerns of Palestinians that next week is a long time away and would give Ariel Sharon the time he needs to continue doing what he's doing now. The Israeli troops reoccupying, reinvading Nablus and Hebron, which will complete the West Bank area. Our guests with us are we have two guests with us, Stephen Zunis, who is speaking to us on the telephone. Stephen Zunis is with Foreign Policy and Focus, chair of the Peace and Justice Studies Program at the University of San Francisco, and Yifat Seskind, who is Associate Director of MADRE. Why has the U.S. done so much to undermine Palestinian leadership, Yifat?
Well, essentially, the United States has, you know, since the end of the Second World War, essentially supported Israel in order to, well, let's start with oil. Oil is really at the heart of U.S. policy in the Middle East, including its suppression of Palestinian leadership, including its overwhelming support for Israel. You know, in 1958, the National Security Council concluded that oil was really the number one concern of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and that the best way to secure the continued access of oil was to form an alliance with Israel. Israel was essentially given the job of helping to maintain conditions in the Middle East that would be favorable to U.S. oil interests there. And the most important thing, as far as that was concerned, was suppressing the rise of Arab nationalist movements. Arab nationalist movements were considered to be movements that, were they to gain power, would likely conclude that the resources of the region, oil foremost, should be used to benefit the region itself, as opposed to going to enrich U.S. oil corporations, which has been the case. To that end, you know, Israel has in various ways suppressed the rise of Arab nationalism across the Middle East, and Palestinian nationalism particularly. Palestinians are considered in many Arab governments to be sort of a loose cannon, both because of their statelessness and their likelihood of you know, joining democratic forces, joining radical forces, as oppressed people do, you know, all over the world. That alliance became really crystallized in 1967 when Israel performed a very important function for the United States, and that was to neutralize Nasser of Egypt, who was the ruling Arab nationalist of his day. When Israel did that, they demonstrated two things to the United States. First, their ability to really confront Arab nationalism and their ability to prevail militarily over a combination of Arab forces. What we've seen since then is a dramatic rise in U.S. military and economic aid to Israel, and a dramatic rise in Israeli human rights abuses against Palestinians. So we have a situation with Israel much like the one we have with Latin America. Colombia is probably the best example today, where there's a very strong correlation between increases in U.S. aid and increases in human rights violations.
Stephen Zunis, the role of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, and then further elaborate on what Yifat Seskin was just saying.
I think AIPAC is definitely an influential lobby, but I think its role is greatly exaggerated. First of all, history has shown that U.S. foreign policy is not that pluralistic in enterprise. It's generally a bipartisan consensus by national security managers. We didn't need a pro-Indonesia lobby to support 24 years of oppression in East Timor. We don't need a pro-Morocco lobby for their occupation of Western Sahara. The United States is perfectly capable of supporting oppressive right-wing allied governments against nationalist struggles, including invasion and occupation, without a strong ethnic lobby to do so. Indeed, if you look at the patterns of aid, as I have, in U.S. policy, there's no real correlation to AIPAC's relative strength. The strongest supporters, most of the strongest supporters of the Israeli government are members of Congress from districts that have a very little Jewish population or in very safe districts where they don't need the campaign contributions. And what concerns me, I think, is the overemphasis on AIPAC is, unfortunately, it diverts attention from the real people who have the power, but also it uncomfortably parallels historic anti-Semitism of blaming these rich and powerful Jews for the problem instead of the real elites who make policy like that. I think it's very much like a China lobby, frankly. If the U.S. decided to turn against Israel, I don't think there's much they could do to stop it. And indeed, the very few times where U.S. administrations have put their foot down, Israel has buckled, and the Israeli lobby was essentially powerless to do so. I mean, I think it's really interesting if you look at the patterns of aid, that if we were really supporting Israel because it was a struggling democracy about to be overrun by the Arab hordes, most of our support would have been Israel's first 20 years of existence, when its strategic situation was the most vulnerable and its democratic institutions were strongest. Instead, the pattern's been just the opposite. 99% of all U.S. aid to Israel took place after 1967, when Israel proved itself to be the strategic asset. And the more powerful Israel has become, the more repressive it has become, the more and more U.S. aid has poured in. Indeed, what's very interesting is the way the U.S. has used Israel to suppress radical nationalist movements, not just among the Palestinians, but in Jordan and Lebanon, the way they funneled arms to third parties the U.S. could not give to directly, like apartheid South Africa, Guatemala under the junta, the Contras, the Islamic Republic in Iran, the way they have tested U.S. weaponry, the way the Mossad and CIA have cooperated in intelligence gathering, covert operations, the way the military-industrial complexes of the two countries are so closely intertwined in the development of everything from new jet fighters to anti-missile defense systems. And what's amazing is how this parallels historic anti-Semitism, where the ruling elites would set up the Jews to be the money lenders and the tax collectors, so everybody would blame the Jews for the problems instead of the people who really had the power. And I talked to at least a half dozen Arab foreign ministers and deputy foreign ministers who have literally told me, when they've asked, why can you still be trusting the United States given how we treat the Palestinians, they say, oh, your ambassador, your State Department explained to me that the Jews really run U.S. foreign policy. I've had top congressional aides when I've lobbied for human rights saying, oh, the senator really agrees with you, but he needs that Jewish money to be elected. You know, it's a classic anti-Semitic scapegoating. And so there's this myth that U.S. policy is too pro-Israel. It's not. I don't think we give a damn about the Jews any more than we do about any historically oppressed people. It's a matter of finding a strategic ally who will do who look out after our interests in that region. That's really what it's about, not an ethnic lobby.
What about the origins of Hamas?
Well, Hamas grew out of some extremist Islamic groupings that emerged, started seeing in the late 70s and more so in the early 80s. And ironically, the Israelis initially encouraged their development. They allowed them to have their own radio station and newspaper. Their people were able to move about far more freely than other nationalists because they saw them as a potential counter to the secular nationalist PLO. I was in Gaza back in 81 when this Islamic mob sacked and burned a PLO health clinic because it was providing contraception for women, and the Israeli soldiers just stood by. I mean, these are people who would sweep up dozens of Palestinian youth if they found some anti-occupation graffiti on the block, but they just stood by. And it was pretty clear what their strategy was. I mean, in certain ways, it was like the South Africans who initially encouraged the Black Consciousness Movement as an alternative to the ANC. But then, of course, it took on a momentum of its own. And while I certainly respected Steve Biko a lot more than I do Sheikh Yassin, and I don't think we should be in any denial about the reactionary nature of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the other radical Islamic groups, it is interesting that the Israelis were very much in the beginning supporting them. And in fact, while the United States is refusing to talk even to the most moderate PLO representatives, U.S. Diplomats in East Jerusalem were regularly meeting with Hamas people throughout the 1980s.
I'm going to give you the last word, Yifat Suskin. As an Israeli who is living here, you're seeing the press whip up a fervor in support of the Israeli state right now, with the U.S. administration saying that they will be going to Israel. It changes and to the occupied territory somewhat as it sort of rallies around the establishment. Your response to what you're seeing here and criticisms of Israelis or Jews who criticize the state of Israel?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of the last few weeks, as have other people who have friends and family in Israel, on the phone checking on the safety of people in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Netanya. And, you know, what I've heard more and more from Israelis who are there is the same thing that I'm hearing from larger and larger segments of the progressive population in the United States, which is that the occupation needs to end, which is that, you know, Israelis who are being killed and wounded by these Palestinian suicide bombers that President Bush, you know, is so rightly condemning, but without a counterpart condemnation of Israeli violence, that those people are really victims of Sharon's policy, because that policy is creating suicide bombers. And Israelis more and more are saying that very openly. I think it's an important connection to make. You know, I think that people in this country really need to understand something that's very obvious everywhere else in the world, which is that the Israeli occupation and the terrible violence that we've seen these last few weeks would not be possible without the funding and the weapons and the diplomatic backing of the United States. You know, Israeli war crimes are U.S. war crimes. It's clear elsewhere. It needs to be understood here, and people need to stop it.
Yifat Suskind, Associate Director of Madre, their website, madre.org, and Stephen Zunis, Senior Policy Analyst and Middle East Editor of Foreign Policy and Focus, that website.
www.fpif.org.
And that does it for the program. Our website gets you contacts of everywhere else, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Looking forward to go to University of California tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I'll say it once again, what you heard.